This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
He was born in the year 164 after Hijrah. His father was a Mujahid. And his father, of course, died when he was around 30, which left Al-Imam Ahmad orphaned. Al-Imam Ahmad was an orphan. And you'll find also many other ulama were orphaned at a young age, like Al-Imam Shafi'i and Al-Imam Al-Bukhari. Following in the footsteps of who? The Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. So Al-Imam Ahmad, Al-Imam Shafi'i, Al-Imam Bukhari, they were orphan following the footsteps of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. So being an orphan isn't necessarily a bad thing. In other words, because you're following the footsteps of these great men. In other words, it's a sign of great things to come. Don't lose hope. So Alhamdulillah, never doubt the divine decree of Allah Azza wa Jal. So he was an orphan. And thus who took over? The mother. And that's where you'll find in terms of his knowledge early on, it was the mother. She was the one planting that seed of iman and knowledge and growth in his heart. And if you have any questions, write it down. We'll take them in the end, inshallah. As for his travel and knowledge, first and foremost, his teacher was his mother. And you find many of the ulama of the salaf, their teachers were females, mothers, sisters. And it shows you the important role of women. So in terms of his travels and his knowledge, first and foremost, he was brought up by his mother, Safiya bint Maymuna. That was her name. What would happen was pre-dawn, in the waqtu sahar, before Fajr, she would wake up, prepare his food, his breakfast, get his books ready, and then she would wrap him up, because it was very cold in the mornings, in Baghdad, very cold. And she would take him to the masjid, so he can pray in Jama'ah, and she would wait outside, and after the prayer go home. No, she would wait until Shuruq, so he can sit there at the feet of the scholars gaining knowledge. The mother. She was the one that planted those seeds. And we're going to see also, he did the same. Al-Imam Ahmad did the same with his kids. Abdullah, his son, he nurtured him really well. So when he died, his son, Abdullah, also known as Abu Abdurrahman, but his son Abdullah took care of the musnad. He nurtured him well. He planted that seed of iman. Because when he died, Al-Imam Ahmad, rahimahullah, the Musnad wasn't complete. The manuscripts and the papers and notes were everywhere. So who took over? His son. What an investment to invest in your kids. Not let's give da'wah to the world and neglect the home. Let's give da'wah to everyone else and neglect the family and neglect your kids. Sometimes you find a person in da'wah, he's a sheikh or a strong student of knowledge, whatever the case may be, or is a volunteer at many events, yet his family's neglected, the wife's neglected, or the kids are neglected. What da'wah is this? It's like having a dentist with bad teeth or a plumber with bad plumbing. Right? It's a contradiction. Start in the home. The scholar said, Al-Usra Nawatul Mujtama. The family is the nucleus of society. That's how we get victory once again, among many other ways, of course. So his mother was the one nurturing him. As the saying goes, don't expect succulent strawberries when you sow in the seed of a cactus. Sah? Sometimes parents, yeah, they sown the seed of a cactus. What are you going to get? You're going to get a cactus. So when he's 15, 16, 17, yeah, I bashum on him or you. Maybe you didn't raise him right. It happens. Yes, Habib. Al-usra, nawatul mujtama. The family is the nucleus of society. So Al-Imam Ahmad, his knowledge started at home with his mother. She'll take him to the masjid every single morning. However, he began his serious study of a hadith at the tender age of 15. 15, that's when he was serious. So he was doing everything before then. But 15, he began serious. Some people get serious, never. So, when he was 15, that's when he started to travel. Khalas, he's a man now. He went to Al-Basra, Al-Kufa, Al-Yaman and Al-Hijaz. And he returned to Baghdad, his home city, after approximately 11 years. So after 11 years of traveling, he returned home. And who does he find when he comes back to Baghdad? The great, illustrious Al-Imam Shafi'i. And thus he becomes his student. So Al-Imam Ahmad studies under a Shafi'i. These were all great men and students of each other, my dear brothers. You find today people that they have this hizbiya mentality where they basically say, you know, if you're not on my way, you're on dalala. This is the haq, bro, and no other way is acceptable. And they follow a particular madhab, and they think every other madhab is wrong, but little do they know, their own imam of that madhab was more tolerant than them. The own imam. You find the students, due to the lack of knowledge, not even knowing the basic biography. This is a very basic seerah, by the way. I'm not giving you everything. But very basic things, I don't even know that Al-Imam Ahmad studied under Al-Imam Shafi'i. And his son, who would always say, I used to hear my father making dua for Al-Imam Shafi'i. Always, always, always. In other words, make dua for your teachers, for your mashayikh. These are people who teach you. They help you, inshallah, try to get to Jannah. His son said, I heard my father constantly make dua for a Shafi'i. He says, why are you making so much dua for him? He says, you see the relationship and the importance of the son to this world? He says, yeah. Well, he said, he is the son to this deen. In other words, after the Sahaba, in our time now, Al-Imam al-Shafi'i is like the son to this deen. Just like you have the importance of the son to the world. Without it, basically, everyone's dead. And that's why it was called Shamsuddin. Literally. You know, because the sun is a source of light, a source of guidance. So Al-Imam al-Shafi'i was that. He was a source of light and guidance for this ummah. So he studied al-fiqh and usul al-fiqh under his Shaykh Al-Imam al-Shafi'i. And he continued teaching up until 214 after Hijrah. And this is when a storm of persecution erupted against the scholars of Hadith, against Ahlul Hadith, throughout the Abbasid Empire. Why? Because the Khalifa at the time accepted the Mu'tazila Aqidah. And this is, of course, a deviant Aqidah we don't accept. So the Khalifa now, this is in terms of the new subcategory, tests, the tests he faced. The Khalifa at the time accepted the Mu'tazila creed. 214 after Hijrah, as we said, a storm of persecution erupted. And among the things that they used to believe and claim was that the Qur'an is created. Ahsant. Is the Qur'an created? Of course not. Because the Qur'an is Allah's words, kalam. And Allah's not created, so the Qur'an can't be created. So therefore, they refused to yield. They refused to submit to this deviant way. And among them, Al-Imam Ahmad. So in the beginning, this Khalifa, when most scholars refused to join him, he first threatened them. When they didn't obey, he persecuted and tortured them. Many, like Al-Imam Ahmad, were persecuted and tortured. He was thrown in prison. 18 months in jail. Imagine that. Great imam, great scholar, in prison for 18 months. You think Supermax is bad? Well, at least there they don't torture you. Perhaps you'll say, yeah, there's psychological torture. That's true. There is that psychological torture in Supermax. But here, it was psychological and physical torture. He was beaten so bad at times, it was mentioned that he broke his wrist. They broke his wrist. It was that bad. And many times he would be knocked out unconscious. He'd be beaten to the extent where they basically KO'd him. A great imam. So much so that his student said to him, look, why don't you use tawriya? What's tawriya? When you say something, it's not a lie, but you give the intent to the person asking that as though you intend something else. This is called tawriya. Like, for example, it was mentioned that Yahya ibn al-Ma'in and Ali ibn al-Madini, these are two great scholars that use tawriya. An example would be, for example, they were told to say that the Qur'an is created. So they will hold the Qur'an up, they'll say, it is created. Meaning, the paper. Yeah, this mushaf, literally. The cover is created, but not the Qur'an. That's called tawriya. So his students asked him, why didn't you do tawriya? Just like Yahya ibn al-Ma'in and Ali ibn al-Madini did. He said, no, I'll tell you why. Go to such and such place and tell me what you see. His student goes, what does he find? Al-Imam Ahmed's students with pen and paper, waiting to see what fatwa he's going to give, what he's going to say, so they can record it in the pages of history. He says, that's why I refuse to yield. Refuse to give in. And thus he earned the nickname of Imam Ahl Sunnah. Imam Ahl Sunnah is Al-Imam Ahmed. So aka Imam Ahl Sunnah. Look at him today. We mention him by literally singing his praises and making dua for him, rahimahullah. Even the other great scholars in his time lived as well. Literally, they were great scholars in his time, perhaps maybe even more knowledgeable. But ikhlas, sincerity, a pure sincere intention, at tawakkul ala Allah, that's what raises your ranks also. Not just knowledge, but it's applying that knowledge. It's applying the knowledge. And that's why it was mentioned also of another great story. When he was in prison, two people before him, they were told to say the Quran was created, and they didn't. What happened? Their heads were chopped off, and Al-Imam Ahmad was next. He's next. And who's next to him? One of the students of a Shafi'i. He thought, this is an opportunity. He asked him, do you have any ahadith from the Shafi'i on, you know, wiping, masah? What? Your head's just about to get lopped off, and you're asking about fiqh? That was one of the stories of Al-Imam Ahmad, shows you his tawakkul. If I'm going to get executed, it's going to happen. And if I don't, well, guess what? I better use this opportunity to gain some knowledge. Because if this guy's executed, I might lose that hadith. That's how he saw it. So that's one of the main and major stories mentioned about Imam Ahmad in prison, to show you his tawakkul and reliance. You know what? If it's going to happen, it's going to happen. Yeah, tawakkul, khalas. And subhanAllah, of course, he wasn't executed. And another amazing story of Imam Ahmad in prison, that he was beaten really hard one day, and he was brought some water after this beating. He was given water, he refused to drink. He says, I don't want to break my fast. He's fasting, he's in prison, and he's getting beaten. He says, I don't want to break my fast. Look at these men, my brothers. That's why Allah preserved their legacy behind. You find us, Allahumma musta'an. This is an authentic narration that's been mentioned about Al-Imam Ahmad. And he lived approximately 8 years after this big test. And this test, by the way, of the claim that the Quran was created, what was it called? It was called Al-Mihna. Al-Mihna, the great test, literally. The Mihna of Imam Ahmad, and it was such a test that actually is extended into the time of Imam al-Bukhari. So he was also subjected to, you know, such claims and insults, and of course false rumors spread about al-Bukhari, which we're going to take also. So after the Mihna, he lived for about 8 years, and most of his period and time was devoted to teaching, while others were spent to just basically staying in the masjid, salah, dhikrullah, ila akhirih. As for his lifestyle, now new subheading, his lifestyle, it was mentioned that he hated luxury. He lived a very simple and austere way of life. Very austere, very simple. It was mentioned that he boycotted his sons just because they took a payment from the Khalifa. That's how much he hated luxury and lifestyle. Once Ahmed al-Wurraq, he said, I came to Al-Imam Ahmed and I complained about poverty. So Al-Imam Ahmed took 4 silver coins, put them in my hand. He said, this is all I got. Al-Imam Ahmed. He only had 4 silver coins at one stage to his name, and he gave it to Ahmed al-Wurraq.
Who was Ahmed al-Wurraq?
He was one of the contemporaries of Al-Imam Ahmed. Another great scholar. So how would he live? Basically, he would live off his father's farm estate. His father left behind a farm estate, and he would live off that land, basically, from the fruit and so forth. But he wouldn't really work. He would dedicate a lot of his time to hadith. And that shows us, my dear brothers, the importance of leaving something behind for your kids. If you want them to be scholars, you want them to be mashayikh, right? You don't want to leave necessarily a business behind where they're working 24/7 and they've got no life. Basically, they wake up, go to work. They come back, they're too smashed to do anything. No, if you're going to leave something for them, leave something so they can not work, literally, but something they can live off as well. So they can also study. As for his character, new subheading, he was extremely gentle, honest, and just. These were among the most outstanding qualities he had in his character. Gentle, he was extremely honest, and he was just. Just to give you an idea of his justice, once he was praying, salatan nafila, an optional prayer. While he's praying, someone comes and steals his shoes and he sees it. What does he do? In qata an salatihi, wajara khalfahu qailan, ya fulan aqbil, ya fulan aqbil. So what does he do? He cuts off his prayer and he chases him down. And he's saying, oh so and so come back, oh so and so come back. Why? So I can beat him? Give him my shoes back? No. He said, أَهْدَيْتُ لَكَ الْحِذَاءِ أَهْدَيْتُ لَكَ الْحِذَاءِ فَقُلْ قَبِلْتُ قُلْ قَبِلْتُ. He's saying, I've gifted you my shoes, I've gifted you my shoes, say I accept. Why? He didn't want that man to fall into sin. He didn't want a thief to fall into sin. Look at his gentleness. Look at his akhlaq. Who would do that today? When I told my dad this story, he says, yeah, I'll chase him down, all right? And I'll belt him so hard, and I'll belt him with those shoes until they literally fall apart. Come in. Tafaddal. Tafaddal, akhi. You can sit. You can sit. Yeah, no problem. Hello. It's your classroom, my brother. So that just shows you, ahlan wa sahlan. That just shows you Imam Ahmad's character. Amazing. Who would do that? Rahmatan lahu. He had mercy for that man, even though he stole his shoes. In other words, he stepped over his pride, he crushed his ego, and he humbled himself. Why? Because he's another believer, another Muslim. That is true akhlaq. True manners is when you display them to those who have none. Anyone can show good manners to those who show good manners to them. That's easy. True? Even animals recognize that. When you give a cat some food and you basically pat it, what does it do? It comes close, it purrs, it sits on your lap. Animals recognize that relationship. To show good manners to those who show good manners to you is easy. Really, your true test of character is when you show it to those who have no character. That's true akhlaq. So that was Al-Imam Ahmad. As for the Musnad, finally we'll take this and his death. The Musnad was mentioned, this famous book, and that's why I mentioned the Musnad before and the Muwatta, so I don't have to repeat all these things and what they are. So the Musnad, how did he compile it? He basically drew from his own personal library, where? In his mind. As well as the entire literature available to him on the subject. So he went traveling, as we said, all those years. So out of 750,000 narrations, he sifted through 30,000. Basically, he sifted 30,000 from 750,000. Allahu Akbar.
30,000?
Yeah, so he basically, out of 750,000 ahadith, he went through them all and he basically extracted the gems and he took out 30,000. It was mentioned he dictated various parts of these hadith to his students, also his sons and nephew for over 13 years. So it was mentioned he compiled, although it's unknown exactly how many years, but you could say at least it took him 13 years to compile. 13 years. You find many of the ulama do this, like Al-Imam Suyuti's Khasa'is, it took him 20 years to compile. So you find many ulama, it takes them a long, don't just think that they just sat there overnight. You know what? Let's put a musnad together. Bang, here you go. So 13 years of struggling, toil, teaching. The musnad. No, the musnad, yeah. Now, he never claimed that all of the musnad's contexts were genuine and reliable. However, he claimed that basically a lot of them would be proven sahih if they were put to the test. However, on the contrary, just to show his ikhlas and his sincerity, he struck off and he deleted and omitted many ahadith from his books, even when he was on his deathbed. He told his son Abdullah, take out this hadith and take out that hadith. To show you that, yani he was sincere. Wasn't that it? Once it's gone to print, khalas, it's the final version. No, these men were searching for the truth, even if it went against their own opinion, their own nafs. Who would do that today? Sometimes you tell a brother, fear Allah, you mention a hadith, and because he's proven wrong, he won't accept it. Why? Just to save face. No. Saving face is when you humble yourself to the truth. And it's been mentioned, although he wanted to assemble his notes in the form of a musnad, he wanted to compile it like that, death overtook him. So this task of arranging his notes and manuscripts was assigned to who? His son, Abdullah. His son took over. Once again, as we mentioned earlier, what an investment. So much so that when this great imam passed away, his son took over. So, Al-Imam Ahmad's son, Abdullah, maintained the scrupulous care and thoroughness of his father's work when editing the material he inherited. He collated all of his father's huge but incomplete manuscript with his own notes, which he had taken at his father's lectures. He would go there. He would take his son to his lectures with him. And other sessions of the muhaddithin, other ulama. He then collated it from what he had learnt from him and others, other ulama, during more, of course, other periods of time. Then, basically, he put it together, and thus, the Musnad was compiled in the end by his son. Something that many people don't know. And finally, this Musnad occupies a very important place in Hadith literature and has served as a source for numerous scholars' works later on. Literally, they would use the Musnad as either commentary or the source of their works. I'll give you two examples. Number one, Ibn Hajar. Use the Musnad basically for his atraf. We talk what atraf means. We've already discussed that. So Ibn Hajar used the musnad for his atraf. Of course, other books of hadith, but among them he used the musnad. And also As-Suyuti. As-Suyuti used a large part of the musnad for his works. So it just shows you that this became a source, a umda, a support for other ulama in the future. And as for his death, finally, he died at 77 years of age. And his funeral was attended by a vast crowd, said to have contained approximately at least 600,000 people to at most 2.5 million. Al-Imam Ahmad. Allahu Akbar. 600,000 at least attended.
What age did he die at?
77 years old. Other narrations say at most 2.5 million. So at best you could say 2.5 million, and worst case scenario 600,000. Just go try getting 6,000 at your funeral. He had 600,000. Showing how Allah Azza wa Jal honors you in this world before the hereafter. It was mentioned this was an event like of which must have rarely been witnessed anywhere in the world at that time. Jazakum Allah khairan, my dear brothers, for your attentive listening. Subhanakallahumma wa bihamdik. Nashhadu an la ilaha illa anta. Astaghfiruka wa natubu ilayk.